ago, we found that only 40% of the companies we analyzed actually disclosed some sort of quantifiable information around their decarbonization strategies.
The 1.5 world is, you know, bonkers because we're nowhere close to that. Is that, should we give up?
Financial markets probably cannot and will not save the world.
Is there a role for AI and technology?
Well, climate change, as you know, all know, is a bit of a long-term risk. And I think humans are not very good at, you know, planning ahead for the very long term.
Welcome to Sustainability Wired, the show where we plug into the thinking that moves sustainable finance. I'm Lorenzo Sa, the Chief Sustainability Officer at Clarity AI, and I'm excited today to cover the topic of climate and climate finance. We're here in London, where there's the summer solstice, the days are extremely long, the weather is amazing. So there's a lot of optimism, especially as we're in the same period of London Climate Action Week. But beyond that optimism, there's the reality of what we see is going on with climate. And in fact, according to the UNEP Emission Gap Report from late 2024, we know that the world is heading at the end of the century to a 2.6 to 3.1 Celsius warming compared to the 1.5 that we've actually set ourselves as a goal. And this is as we head towards Belém and COP30, where a number of countries haven't yet declare their national determined contributions, which for now seem to be quite short of what those ambitions need to be to actually achieve the 1.5 that we all set ourselves against. And, you know, the reality of that is actually impacting the world we're in. If you think about it, 2024 has been the hottest year in our climate on record that we've measured in the last centuries, and the 2023 was the hottest year the year before. So we clearly are in a heating and a warming world, and that's having impact in our own lives. I'm from Northern Italy, and just in April, floods devastated the plains, farmlands, economy, and societies in the region were damaged. And Canada, in just the last few weeks, we know have gotten over 200 wildfires that have actually created a huge amount of smog that and fumes that have actually spilled into the U.S. and a number of states have actually been, again, impacted both from a society perspective, but as well as from an environmental perspective. So the question is, has actually climate finance done what it's said on the tin? Are we actually failing as an investment community? And as we think of that, we as a climate finance community are also having our own headwinds to face with. Think about how a lot of institutional investors have had left from some of the net zero initiatives and some of the financial institutions have led, for example, the banking initiatives or the insurance initiatives. And even the net zero asset management initiative has taken a pause and is reflecting how to reconsider its modus operandi that will be restated most likely in the fall this year. And regulations on climate is changing. Think about how today in the US, regulation has been pulled back around climate. But even in Europe, the disclosure encouragement that were coming through the previous EU administration is kind of looking at a different way forward, and the omnibus regulation and policy is likely to reduce the amount of climate information that will be in the market. Basically, there's a slowdown that goes from voters to investors, and even from a performance perspective, there's questions. You know, the climate funds have underperformed against the fossil fuel profits, and there's a sense that even wind actions in the US and the UK have been quite slow, and the EU sales have plateaued. And this is signaling some sort of concern and reckoning for the climate agenda globally. So today, we're excited to actually tackle this. We want to tackle this from what got us here, what can we do about it? In other words, what can we keep doing and what we might need to change? And then question, is it more mitigation? Is it adaptation? Is it something else that we need to take on to actually ensure that climate and climate finance push forward? And then there's a question, is there a role for AI and technology? And if so, does that role a positive role or is it a negative role? Is it contributing to actually further damaging our climate? And so I'm super excited for our guest today. It's our very own Nico Fettes, and he is here as the head of our climate activities at Clarity AI. And with that, he brings, you know, his expertise both from a science perspective, but also on a regulatory understanding and how that impacts the portfolio level decisions of a number of investors that work with us. He comes from CDP as the head of product development for capital markets, where he co-created Climetrics, which was one of the first climate ratings for investment funds. And he's had experience also on the other side. In fact, Nico has brought in policy expertise both from the German government as well as the EU overall. And he started at one of the asset managers and specifically at JP Morgan Asset Management, helping and advising institutional investors. So, Nico, we're excited to have you and we're super keen to hear all about your background, both from a policy as well as a solution perspective. So, Nico, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Lorenzo. Thanks very much for having me. And it's a great pleasure to be your guest today.
That's great. And look, we're going to start from a personal touch. Where did the sustainability and this climate passion come from? Was this something that really started in your childhood or something that came after? How did you get here and spending so many hours and time on climate?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I was definitely a kid playing or spending a lot of times outdoors in the forest and so forth. But I would say that was not the trigger. It was more like something related to what you mentioned previously, a bit my life at JP Morgan Asset Management, which I truly enjoyed. But also at the time, I was in fact advising Big Oil. So these were like my prime, clients. I was starting to wonder, what problems am I helping to solve there? And then also a bit cliche, but then I had some sort of deeper nature experiences. So I was questioning a bit my role there as like professionally what I was doing there. Is that in line with my personal values and so forth? And I decided it's not. So I started to look around, see how I can apply my knowledge about finance, financial markets. And then with a short stopover working for a Swedish life insurance company where I learned a lot about investing and portfolio management. Then the opportunity came up to join CDP, and that was under an EU grant to bring to life something that was truly unique at the time, so a climate rating for funds. I sort of took that opportunity, and then over time I developed a really deep passion for the topic, especially on working with the data and deriving insights from climate related disclosures, which is a bit my sort of core focus area in the field of sustainable finance.
Great. So basically, the oil majors inspired you towards this climate career, which that's awesome. Well, look, I kicked off the episode today a little bit highlighting some of the concerns that we have on climate, both from a purely outcome perspective as well as where the climate finance industry is. What got us here?
So if you mention about the mismatch a little bit between the role of sustainable finance and how I think the ever more prominent position it got in over the past 10-15 years in financial markets, all the work that has been going into it, and then where we actually are in terms of emissions. So global emissions are in fact rising, not falling. So you can, and people are speaking about financial markets as sort of providing the capital flows and it's the backbone of our economies. So you can definitely question a bit, so what have we achieved and why haven't we achieved more? And you know, it's certainly an interesting question. I think, in my perspective, so financial markets probably cannot and will not save the world. You know, so maybe over the years, and I was especially, I think, part of it, we're a bit like naive thinking that we could, you know, shift some of the fundamental principles of financial markets or the way they operate and their work, which is about, you know, making short-term returns, you know, and maximizing profits. And, you know, also that's because what we sort of want from financial markets, us as savers and retail investors. So, you know, maybe we're a little bit overconfident about their ability to turn the ship around. That has not materialized. Also because, you know, climate change, as we all know, is a bit of a long-term risk. And I think humans are not very good at, you know, planning ahead for the very long term. So I do think we are where we are today is primarily because of the lack of, you know, the right policy environment for to tackle climate change and to support climate action. So I think financial markets have a great role and an important role in supporting that, but we need those policy incentives for it to work. Unfortunately, policymaking is also not doing that, so they don't have the long-term perspective either, and a lot of biased by short-term considerations and other important issues like wars, for example.
Yeah, it's interesting. It reminds me a little bit of Bob Eccles that says, you know, the fact that you have a need doesn't mean that you have an opportunity, and investors will be driven by an opportunity, not necessarily to deliver a need on itself. And yes, policymakers are backtracking. So maybe knowing that the institutional investors can't solve it all, which is what you're saying, there is an element of what can the institutional investors address. So maybe, Nico, on this angle of the transition plans, right? So is that, should we be investing more on that? Should we be encouraging those transition plans more? And if we are, should this be an investment-led push, or should this be a regulatory push?
Yeah, no, I think it's it should definitely be an investment-led push, and I think it's in the interest of investors to because it helps them to diversify also their portfolios if they have, you know, more sectors to choose from rather than just building like clean, very concentrated portfolios. So I think the goal here for them would be, you know, work with these companies and help them transition, give them capital, provide the capital to do that. But also, you know, it requires a new level of understanding of sectors and the requirements for each sectors on the companies in each sectors to transition. So it requires a knowledge of, you know, the technologies that that need to be deployed in these sectors and the barriers to that, which sometimes also goes back then again to, you know, making sure there's the right policy environment for that. Yeah, and then, you know, what are the obstacles and external dependencies that companies face in transitioning. So I think these are more more important aspects in this transition finance endeavor, I would say.
And when we think about transition finance, still a lot of the conversation is around how do we get to net zero, and is 1.5 the target? Is it a realistic goal that we still should continue to push forward? And, you know, there's quite a lot of a conversation of now is building scenarios in my portfolio about a 1.5 world is, you know, bonkers because we're nowhere close to that. Is that, should we give up? Should we keep doing what we're saying? And what should be a healthy design of these net zero initiatives, which investors are part of, so that they can move forward in a way that's realistic and constructive for their portfolio management?
Yes, so for me, it's definitely still a concept and framework that is still alive. So, and I think we should, as an ecosystem, as an industry, we should keep it alive. It's, for me, it's not some type of business KPI that we should adjust just because, you know, the odds of meeting that global goal has they have become unfavorable. So I like to quote Johan Rockström, who is the director of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Research, and they are not far from where I live in Berlin, in Germany. So, and he recently pointed out that, you know, this is not 1.5 is not just a goal; it's like actually a scientific limit, and crossing that limit risks like irreversible damage, climate tipping points. We know all of that. And so it's really a boundary of resilience for the planet's resilience. So I think it's in all of our interest to keep the ambition high, to keep that 1.5 degree goal alive. And even if that means that the road to get there is probably not attainable by financial markets alone or the economy alone, it needs like broad stakeholder involvement, especially policy making.
So, is there a role for investors in adaptation? We know that right now 98% of funding for adaptation is coming from public sources. So is there a role for private sector, and what does that look like? Is it just niche to, say, insurance sectors or the infrastructure, or is there broad across asset classes potential for adaptation and therefore for the institutional investor space to come in and address this part of the climate set of actions?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, adaptation finance, as you said, is often like understood as sort of public funding to support communities, countries, individuals to cope with the effects of climate change. You know, building flood defenses, better water resource management, developing new types of crops that are more, you know, better resistant to climate change. So all of that. I think also it's a key topic of, you know, debates at COP and other climate gatherings, where it's about, you know, the money flows from developed to developing countries. So yeah, the topic has been very prominent in that sort of setting. But I do also see that emerging more and more as a topic in our field of sustainable finance, climate finance, where we cater and provide services to public markets, so asset managers, asset owners, banks, and so forth. Yeah, we do know also, you know, it's relevant for the insurance business, but maybe more in the recently as a sort of a lack of adaptation finance. So, you know, property insurance in the US has become prohibitively expensive, so or not available anymore. So that is also happening. But I see it maybe two ways how it emerges at the moment is one in the area of climate solutions finance. So, you know, we've had the market has grown a lot and developed a lot of expertise around clean tech, climate tech, and, you know, measuring you know, what solutions, what services lead to emissions reductions, and then there's the string where, you know, that's coming alive now. So where also solutions for adaptation are emerging and being added to the list of climate solutions to invest in. And companies that are providing these solutions. Then the other string of thought, or maybe it's complementary, is the recognition that, you know, in the face of actual short-term risks that we're all facing now, and they're more visible, investors are looking to understand if companies have strategies to manage them. So this is more about adaptation planning at the side of the company. So I would say my first point on climate solutions finance, that is probably, as I said, more well understood. We have more experience with this. In terms of adaptation planning by companies, that's maybe more of a new field. where there's more work that has to go into that. Even though I have to say the TCFD, as you know, a couple of years ago already recommended companies to disclose, the results from scenario planning, and I think it goes in a similar direction. So we want companies to do that exercise of going through different climate scenarios and tell us how it could affect their business, and then from that, obviously, it's a strategic management tool, derive certain plans and actions. And I think that's kind of what we're talking about here. It's in terms of, understanding the company, how the company arrives at certain decisions, and how it adapts to climate change from that. Yep. So these two things are evolving. They are not so new, but I think now becoming a bit more to the forefront.
But aren't either of these approaches to adaptation reliant on physical assets understanding? So does this mean that the institutional investors need to stop gathering information data from a company level? And do they need to now go and figure out where does every single asset location of my company production sites are? And by the way, I actually need to know that same set of information for my supply chain and all of their own physical assets to be really on top of what risks there are from adaptation perspective. And if that's the case, are we anywhere near the possibility to do that?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I do see, we do observe and we do speak with more and more providers of sort of asset level physical risk data. So I think more companies are emerging that are trying to serve that need and, help financial institutions. I think at the moment, it's mostly insurers and infrastructure investors to better understand the financial risk related to, and this is mostly about acute, but also chronic weather events to very specific assets, as you say, specific assets and specific locations, and under then different scenarios of global warming. And I think, this type of new data does meet very specific needs of those investors. But you alluded to it already with referencing supply chains, but I think at the moment these offerings, they fail to capture a bit of the broader effects of physical climate risks on companies' bottom line. So they don't typically account for... So what they do is they measure risk to the value of the building or an infrastructure site. But then what they don't do is look at, okay, how could that affect the company's loss in revenues, from building damage or from supply chain effects, which I have a feeling could be in many cases a lot worse than the actual damage to the building. So I think, and then on top of that, the models that we observe, they're highly complex. They rely on lots of granular data, input data, asset locations, asset values, and you need to do a precise mapping of those assets to the companies, which is in, so you have a lots of maintenance work going on there, lots of room for error, I would say. And then for me, there's also this open questions whether this should actually, modeled by data providers or financial institutions look from the outside, right? So I agree. So insurance companies and infrastructure investors might have a use case here and a need for that. But for the broader markets, is that actually the way to tackle the problem? Or would it be better if there was a new demand on companies to go through that exercise because they understand best their supply chains and their assets and all the ripple effects that global events could have? So should it be more the demand on companies to get into the rhythm of thinking about scenarios and adaptation plans, as I said earlier. So maybe that's a more scalable approach, and also maybe it makes more sense to demand this information from companies directly.
knowing that it's likely going to be slow progress, given also some of the geopolitical headwinds, is there a role for technology to help us take the agenda forward, even if the policy agenda is slow? So in other words, AI, you know, we work with it, but, you know, the world is moving on trying to figure out how to use it. Is AI going to help climate and climate finance forward? And how do you see this happening?
Yeah, I think it's also an area where I think we're all sort of have, you know, now faced, have the privilege of being able to work with this new technology. So, and it's, you know, we all know it's fascinating. And I think in many corporations, and us included, we're looking at ways to deploy it. When it comes to our specific area of work, I mean, most of the benefits that are normally, you know, stated alongside, you know, using, and I'm talking about generative AI, you know, they also apply to our work. So it's definitely a technology can help us making analysis, data analysis, more efficient, and we can scale things more easily. There's also other means of using AI for machine learning, where we can fill gaps in the data that we have, so we get a more holistic and a more complete picture. Yeah, but then there's also this element of, you know, its environmental impact. So here we know that it's a technology that that has a lot of has a very big environmental impact. It's probably, according to the IEA, I read recently that it's probably going to be depending on the level of AI adoption, but there's a scenario where it could become the most you know, the fastest growing sector in terms of energy use and emissions, and also the water consumption is high, as we know. So yeah, we need to see what we can, like, how to balance this, especially in the area of sustainability, right? So there's us using it for, like, data research, data analysis. There's also actual technologies that, you know, sort of in the field of AI for good, so where, you know, actual solutions are just based on technology to make farming more efficient or energy management more efficient. So that's the sort of the counter effect. So we have a technology here, and that's a bit my anxiety here. There's a new technology coming to the world, which is super energy and resource hungry. And at the same time, it can help us solve many of the challenges. So I'm a bit torn in between. So I haven't fully made up my mind, but we should eventually decide, like, what do we want to use it for, and is it an effective use of that technology? So I'm not a big fan of using it for autonomous cars, you know, self-driving cars, but it's a technology that could be very helpful in many other areas, and we'll see how that plays out.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the earlier guests, Neil Brown from GIB Asset Management, brought specifically out how he felt that the technology in autonomous cars saves a humongous amount of lives, and why he sees that as a particular sustainable investment. But look, I maybe more on the climate side, I've known that you've done a great piece of work around how AI can help on analyzing climate transition plans. Can you highlight just briefly what your conclusions were there and how AI helped you?
Yes, so coming from the climate research side of things, so AI, I'm very excited also about this certain technology, because for the first time, you know, we're sitting in front of a pile of climate data, and when I speak of clarity, we do have a lot of data, and we have access to thousands of company documents and reports. So in the past, it had always been very frustrating not being able to analyze this, and there was a bit of FOMO, so fear of missing out on that information. So now, what we can do now, so we have built an internal tool that allows us to access all that information, in a more structured way, so we can dig into unstructured information and get structured information back, which is beautiful. And for transition plan analysis, we use the technology to go a bit deeper to improve our understanding, especially on the topic of decarbonization levers. So, and this is more about now tackling the question of how do companies aim to achieve their targets. So we want to dig deeper into that. So what type of technologies are they employing, and is it the right technologies for the sector that they're in? And then also, do they disclose like quantifiable actual hard data on this? So we want to also separate like cheap talk, greenwashing from actual hard data on this. So AI can be a very useful tool, and we so deployed it to analyze high impact sectors. In this analysis from a few months ago, we found that only 40% of the companies we analyzed actually disclosed some sort of quantifiable information around their decarbonization strategies. So more than half of the companies, they talk about it, but in a very loose or, you know, not very decision useful way. And then just recently, actually yesterday, released another article where we looked at more deeply into the decarbonization levers of big tech and their data centers. So what levers are they pulling and deploying? Do they do enough to decarbonize this fast growing source of emissions? So the technology really helps us do things more at scale. It's a very good sparring partner, but it does, and everyone, I think it's a common understanding, it does still need a lot of human oversight and human validation to make it work properly.
Yeah, so we shouldn't only have FOMO because we didn't go to a party, but we're seemingly going to have FOMO because we didn't use AI in our sustainable investment process. That's really funny. I think we should move into our quick fire rounds. We're starting to head towards the end. Lick, this is just, I'll basically put you in front of a quick question where you have a few seconds to give me an answer or a response. So the first thing is mitigation or adaptation. Where should we double down in the next 5 years?
Definitely mitigation. I still have hopes that we can still turn the ship around.
Great. So what about looking at the tools, the climate tools or frameworks out there? Is there a specific climate tool or framework that you say, if you have to pick one, focus on that?
Yeah, of all the ones that I've come across and worked with, I still think the IIGCC's net zero investment framework is the best one for its straightforwardness, simplicity, but still comprehensiveness. So it strikes a very good balance, I think.
Excellent. And in terms of, if you had to pick one climate data point that you think is underrated, what would that one be?
Yeah, one that actually we also haven't really spent a lot of time on, but I would, going forward, look deeper into how companies manage external dependencies for achieving their targets, because I think that's a very important topic. So how do they work with their stakeholders, clients, and others to influence them to achieve their targets? Because in a lot of sectors, companies need to do that. There's a lot of external dependency for achieving climate goals.
Is that kind of a measure of quality of transition plans?
It is, yeah. So it is part of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So maybe sticking on transition plans, should we have transition plans for climate separated by transition plans for nature, or should they be combined?
Yeah, over time they should be combined. My strong view is there's no climate without nature. So at the moment, it's probably we are misaligned in the sort of quality and availability of the data, but we should all work towards combining those two themes.
Great. And if there's one buzzword in climate finance that we should just ban, what would it be?
Yeah, I don't know about buzzword, but I always stumble across this thing about land use change that word, that terminology, because I think it's a euphemism for like just destroying forests. Okay. Maybe I'm not like having the full picture, but I just don't like that term.
Excellent. Last one. Is there a common mistake that investors make when thinking about climate risk?
Oof. It's tough, but I would say ignoring the long term. That doesn't count, apply to everyone, obviously, but we talked about it. But I think, and it's when I say investors, it's also us, ourselves, with our investments. So we create the incentives for others in the system, but yeah, we're too often ignoring the long term.
Great. So we are next into the art twist section of the podcast. As you would know, we bring each guest and ask them to comment on the previous guest's choice of a piece of art or culture that brings sustainability and the work of art together. And we comment on the previous guest and we ask you to tell us what your piece of art might be or a piece of culture be. So you've probably taken a look at Alex Edmonds' proposals in the previous episode, which was the song The Circle of Life by Elton John. So did you know it? And if you did or did not, did you enjoy it? And what did you take out of that?
Yeah, so I did not know the song before, I have to say. So I just went and listened to it. Not necessarily my type of music, but you know, very good and a very powerful song. I do think what Alex said, you know, resonated with me, and I think with a lot of other people as well. So, and perhaps one line of the song, "You should never take more than you give," resonated quite strongly with me. I recently read about life of indigenous people in different parts of the world, and I think it reminded me a bit, because I think they maybe they are the indigenous people know how to live in true harmony with nature and the environment, because they don't feel like nature and environment is something they need to control and be the master of, but they just, you know, are part of it, and they have this feeling of interdependence with it. So I think I think in Western societies we've kind of lost this knowledge and wisdom.
Great. Well, it's interesting how an Elton John is bringing so many interesting, almost spiritual conclusions. And obviously you and I have not seen Lion King, but the vast majority of people have and know the song. Yeah, exactly. Look, but what did you bring to us?
Yeah, so I brought a book. So it's the title is here. It's in German, this title. But the book's called A Whole Life by the Austrian author Robert Seethaler. It's a very easy read. It's a novel. It tells the story of a poor guy, a very simple man who grows up in a remote alpine village in the 20th century. Had a very harsh childhood, then worked as a laborer and cableway builder. And he had one love in his life, but the woman dies in an avalanche. And then during World War II, he was sort of became a prisoner of war and only returned back to his village in the 50s. So he spent many years in Russia. It doesn't sound like the most upbeat story, but you know, the guy is an interesting character, because despite his loneliness, loss, and change in his life, he remains very humble and very connected to nature, and you know, lives a very dignified life in the end still. So I think it's for me it was so I like these sort of stories, because I think climate change and biodiversity loss, they are at the very, very heart of it. I think they are a crisis of the human mind. So, and I think novels like this just help me reflect on how often we live very detached from nature, running about after things, very complicated things that we don't actually need and that don't make us happy. and we are not accepting life and nature as it is, and that everything changes, and we can't control. So, yeah, it's a bit philosophical here, but I think sort of that's my sustainability twist to that book, a very living a humble life. Yeah.
Awesome. So, yes, it seems like the headwinds are in that book, and that there's a response that is about resilience and humbleness, and that's great. So thank you, Nico. And look, I think we need to start to wrap up. My kind of takeaways here is, look, we have climate impacts. They're here. They're now. We seem to know that we need to face these. And what I take away from what you've called upon in this session is really, first, that there is a focus that is needed, as you said, around mitigation and getting the mitigation element right. It's about digging into what data sets exist, being those either at the asset allocation level, but also at the corporate level, as long as they're the right data sets that help investors to then take material decisions. There's then a call around the role of adaptation. And adaptation, I really like that you kind of split it out into two pieces. There's the solution set of adaptation that we're probably more commonly think about. But there's also that element about how do we design resilient plans, and what are the investment that the companies need to have resilient plans into scenarios which are actually today hit by the consequences of the climate change we have. And then there is that third element around what is the role of innovation. And I really enjoyed your balanced view of, look, there is clearly an element of how innovation can address research, can address basically decision-making of your investment portfolio, but there's limits to what that can be done. And those limits include an environmental limit and an environmental impact. And it's great that you just released this research about how the data centers specifically can or cannot be managed in a way to reduce those climate impacts. So look, in thinking of this and even preparing for this session, I thought that one of the things, knowing you, would resonate in terms of what is a message to close the session today. And Cristiana Figueras, from, you know, who's the UNFCCC architect of the Paris Agreement, stated, and I hear a quote, "Stubborn optimism is not about blindly ignoring reality. It's about facing it head on and then doing everything in your power to change the outcomes." And clearly you highlighted, Nico, in this session, where the power of the investors is and where it is not, and wherever is possible, I think that investors should do their part into driving, you know, the climate finance agenda forward, both from a materiality perspective and, if an investor is interested, also from impact perspective. So, Nico, thanks so much for jumping in and being part of this podcast, and really appreciate it. Thanks also for all the production teams behind the scene, Nico, beyond Nico's Curtis File, and also everyone in the studio. And look, if you enjoyed the show, please like, subscribe, share comments, and we are looking forward to seeing you at the next episode. And until then, stay wired.
Copyright 2025 Clarity AI. All rights reserved. Clarity AI does not assess current market trends, legal or regulatory developments, but only opines on recent ESG-relevant developments. The information and data contained herein are proprietary of Clarity AI and or third-party content providers. These are intended for informational, non-commercial use only and may not be copied, distributed, or used in any other way, including via citation. They are not directed to or intended for distribution to or use by India-based clients or users, and their distribution to Indian resident individuals or entities is not permitted. These do not constitute an endorsement of any product, project, investment strategy, or consideration of any particular environmental, social, or governance-related issues as part of any investment strategy. Nor an investment advice or expert opinion are not part of any offering and do not constitute an offer or indication to buy or sell securities, and have not been submitted to or received approval from any relevant regulatory bodies. Clarity AI assumes no responsibility for the reliability, completeness, or accuracy of any opinion provided herein, and makes no representation or warranty as to any of the information, including, without limitation, any representation or warranty that the information or any portion of it is accurate, complete, or suitable for a particular purpose. Clarity AI nor its content providers are responsible for any damages or losses arising from use of this information. and use is subject to conditions available at clarity.ai.